thank you. This is a pleasure being here, and I want to thank the committee for inviting us here. We have been having quite a time for the few days that we've been here, and it's going to be one of those unforgettable experiences. I am Clarence Snyder, and I am a recovered alcoholic. And every time I get up to make a talk, frankly, I never really know what's going to come out. But something usually does, and for a long time. So make yourselves comfortable, and I'll try. Of course, AA, you're supposed to tell about how it was, and what happened, and how it is now. I promise you I will not give you a drunkalogue. I see no point in it. But whatever comes out, why, it won't be a drunkalogue, I'm sure. But I got here by a series of miracles, and I feel that our whole fellowship here, the formation of this fellowship, is a result of miracles. And my coming here, I think you'll agree after I tell you about how it happened, it couldn't be anything else but a miracle. I was married to a girl, Dorothy, you'll find her name running all through that Dr. Bob book, and she was a member of a very clannish family, and her family invented togetherness, and that family was always together in my house. And they had some unusual traditions that they followed, one of which was they had family conferences in my house, to which I was never invited. I was usually the subject under discussion. And the discussion usually ran along the lines of whether they're going to throw me out again or let me back in again. I had been, in previous years, in the finance business, banking and finance. And I drank myself out of that, and I wound up on the bum. And I was between jobs for several years. And my wife's family were very much concerned about this lack of work on my part. And they were trying all the best they could do to get me to change my direction. And as it happened, they were all civilians. They were not alcoholics. And they were people that think. They use their heads. Alcoholics do not think. We emote. And we only do things when we feel like it. Well, they are a thinking crew. And they got a real bright idea one time. Her brother owned a big tractor trailer outfit, and he hauled merchandise between Cleveland and New York and back again. My home was in Cleveland. And they got the bright idea that they could kill two birds with one stone by getting me to go to work with my brother-in-law. This would give me a paying job. It also would enable him to ride herd on me and police me to see that I didn't drink. Now, this is good thinking. But, of course, you know what the good thinking amounts to. So I had to go along on this deal, and I started on a trip to New York with him. Now, that was probably pretty close to 50 years ago, almost that, 40-some. And to this day, I've never had my hands on the wheel of that truck, because I got away from him in Albany on the way to New York City. And I don't have to tell you what happened. He had to pull that rig over the curb and finally rest. And he told me that he was going to take a nap for 2 or 3 hours. And I got away from him and started down the street to the first watering hole I could find. I had a dollar and some change that he didn't know I had in my pockets. And so I had enough to get a start with. But the first watering hole I got into was too rich for my blood. So I went on down a few blocks and I found a place that was more suitable to a man of my estate. And I found an eager beaver in there. He was an angel. And some people might call him something else. But to me, he was an angel. And he started buying me drinks. And I was taking him in as fast as he'd buy them. But finally, the thing got pretty risky there, so I thought I better be leaving. And I went in the bathroom in the men's room, locked the door, and went out the window and went back to the truck. And I left my newfound friend there waiting for me, which is going to be a long wait, as 40-some years ago. I got back to the truck, and my brother-in-law was sleeping on the seat. I was asleep up there by the little window in the back. And on the way back to the truck, apparently, those drinks probably all hit me because I had not had a drink for 2 days, which was a record for me. I was an everyday drinker. And by the time I got there and in my efforts to try to get up in my nest, I stepped on his poor boy's face. And of course he came too and church was out. He knew what was happening and I got Hail Columbia. And he carried me on to the New York City and threw me out and told me this is the end of the line, don't ever come back home. This is my last chance. Well, I didn't have any money by that time. I had no clothes, only I had no overcoat. It was winter time again. As I say, everything happens to me in the winter for some reason or other. And I had to exist. And I existed a long time in New York City. And I want to tell you, an alcoholic, if you're a real rummy, you can exist any place. You take this desert out here, somebody sends a rummy out there in a desert where there's nothing around for 100 miles, send him out for some water, he'll come back with a jug of corn. And so I was in New York City, and I might say all the time I was there, I never bought a meal, I never paid a night's room rent, and I never bought a stitch of clothes, and I start saving money. How do you like that? I'd been out of work for a long time, and these truckers come over there, they wanted someone to watch their outfit. Well, they went and got a bed for the night and had a night on the town waiting for a load back wherever they were heading for. They used to pay me 50 cents a night to sleep in their outfit as a watchman. 50 cents a night. Anyone could have stolen that outfit with me in it, but they didn't know I was drunk all the time. I had 2 jugs of corn with me all the time. I might say that when you get down to the nitty-gritty of things in drinking, one does not cut down on the amount of his drinking, only the quality of it. And I was paying 7 cents a pint for my booze, and I bought it in a wallpaper store. I was drinking derail, we call it. Some people call it smoke. It's strictly nothing but denatured alcohol mixed with anything you want to mix it with, mostly water. But it does the job. But believe me, don't start out on that stuff. You have to work yourself down to that. You have to get conditioned. But if you want to save money drinking, there is my solution. I could tell you how I ate. I'm going to tell you, if you ever get on the bum, fellas and gals, go to New York. There are more suckers per square mile in New York City than any place else. And they are all available. I'm a guy that wanders around and gets his nose into things. And New York was a this is an adventure. But I was adventuring because I had to. I had gone out to my sister-in-law's house in Yonkers. I thought she would take me in when her brother had thrown me out. So I knew where she lived because she lived way up on a hill in Yonkers. I'd been there on my honeymoon. As I say, we did everything together in that family. But I got out there, instead of going up on a hill, I went down a hill, and I got into the Italian section down there. And those were bootleg days, and all Italians had wine. Most of them made it, and a lot of them sold it, and I guess they all drank it, and some of them shared it with their friends. And I went down there and made friends. And the time I got up to Virginia's house, I was a sight for sore eyes. Well, I can't remember too much about that visit to her home, except that I was rolling around on the floor with her two little girls, little babies. They were probably 2, 3, 4 years old, just little tykes. And they were having a lot of fun, but Virginia didn't see much fun in this. She took a dim view of this. So she threw me in the back of her car and took me downtown and threw me out where her brother had thrown me out. And that was it. So I had to exist. So here's how I existed in New York. This is the only part of my past drinking that I probably will talk about very much. Because somebody may need this. You may go on a bum sometime. I want you to know how to conduct yourself in New York. I watched things going on, and I found something very interesting in New York City. I found an automat. I don't know if any of you folks have been around an automat, but they had them in Philadelphia and they had them in New York. And the automat was a place where you go for people who are in a big hurry to get their lunch, and they put nickels and so forth in little slots, and they get out sandwiches or soup or coffee or whatever they want. And I watch people in New York City, and everyone's in a hurry. You never find anybody lolling along like they do down south. Everybody's just running back and forth. And at noontime, it's a calamity there. They all tear out of those offices and run out to get something to eat. And I think most of them have a half hour for lunch, so some of them don't go to restaurants. They go to the automat. And they don't even bother to sit down when they eat. They get their little stuff out of there and get up at a table, and they eat, and they're talking to one another, and they never even know what they're eating. So this gave me an idea. The old rummy bean working. Here's where to get some good food. So I tried an experiment. I'm sort of a student of human nature, you know. I've always have been. Which helped me a lot later on when I got into sales work. I went out on the curbstone and rubbed my one hand in the dirt along the curbstone and made it good and grimy. And I sidled up alongside a couple of these guys that are talking at each other, and they don't even know what they're eating. And I reached up with this dirty hand and put it in this one guy's plate and started taking something off his plate. It takes a little crust to do this. But what happens, human nature takes over. The guy, the first thing he wants to do is belt me. But I look up at him with those baleful eyes, I'm hungry, I'm starving, and he gets so frustrated he walks away and leaves the whole bloody thing, and that's what I want in the first place. Now, I didn't have to eat every day, and you couldn't pull that scam every day either, because you had to regulate your time somewhat, but I wasn't much on eating anyway, but you had to eat to keep the body and soul alive. Clothes, if I needed something, I would go to the mission. I never could handle mission food. Even the thought of it today makes me sick. I'm convinced that in these missions, they get this stale bread that they can't sell in these bakeries and groceries, and they just hand it to a mission. And it sits around there, and if you've ever been in any missions, you know that all you can smell in those places is bug juice. They spray everything and everybody that comes in. So that bug juice, that odors everywhere, and of course it picks up in those donuts and all that stuff that's been laying around there for a week or so. So those donuts lay there and nobody eats the bloody things, so I think they just turn them over to another mission when they get tired of looking at them or they get a little bit cruddy. So you try to eat that stuff, and it's just not possible. I can't anyway. But I found out how to eat without eating at the missions. But missions were good for clothes. If you needed some shoes, which you often lose because people steal them on you, and shoes or anything else you need, you go to the mission, you have to sing. You don't have to be a marvelous singer or anything, so long as you sing, and you go ahead and hit that sawdust trail, they'll give you whatever you need. So you don't have to buy clothes in New York. And I slept in those trucks where I'm out of trouble. I can't get in any trouble doing that. And I'm getting 50 cents a night for watching this truck. Well, listen, spending 7 cents a pint for booze, you can't drink that much. And I'm saving money. Out of 50 cents a night, I'm getting a bankroll. I'm becoming a capitalist. When I got back home, I had a lot more money than when I started. Just by being frugal. I call that frugal. Eating other people's food and wearing somebody else's clothes and sleeping in trucks. So now, so much for the lesson in frugality. Eventually, I wanted to get back home. I guess we all get the homing instinct. So one trucker took me as far as Erie, another one brought me the rest of the way into Cleveland. Well, something happened while I was, after I left Virginia's house in Yonkers. Here's the beginning of the miracle. She had their doctor over there one night, and they were family friends or something. Anyway, he was there. Maybe I infected the kids, I don't know. But whatever, he was there, and they got to talking about drinking, which was one of the favorite subjects in bootleg days. And she related the incident of my visit there and related to this doctor what a nice guy I used to be, her favorite brother-in-law, and what a no-good drunken bum I am now. And he said this, you know, that's odd. He says, I have a brother-in-law here in New York who's a lush. And he met some strange cult of people down here at the Calvary House. They call it the Oxford Movement. And since he's been going down there, he goes around New York trying to fix drunks. And he brings them home, and they all, the best he can ever get with them, they smash up his stuff at home. And he isn't doing too hot with the drunks, but it's keeping him sober. And he said, there's another man belongs to this Oxford cult down here in Akron, Ohio, Dr. Robert Smith. Says, if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down and meet this Dr. Smith, and this doctor can fix him. We call it fixing. We still call it fixing around our house. Of course, I don't know this is going on, but Virginia wrote Dorothy about this. So when I got home, I'm trying to get in my house, and I'm not making it. Dorothy won't let you on unhit the screen door. I'm putting on all my wiles trying to get in the house. But it's not working. I see that it's not going to go. But she told me about this doctor in Akron and asked me if I'd like to meet him. So I have nothing to lose. I say I can transact my business in Akron as well as in Cleveland. So she takes me down to the bus depot. She gave me Doc Smith's name and address. And she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron and goodbye. She got rid of me. That's how I met my sponsor, Dr. Bob. Now, here's the thing about it. That lush in New York was Bill Wilson, and the lush in Akron was Dr. Bob. The doctor was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, Dr. Leonard Strong, who was visiting Virginia. What do you call all that? I'm in New York. That's the only people I know, and they are hostile. And through them, I'm inadvertently get in touch with these two birds that are credited with starting this whole thing. Now, this was a long time ago. So, that is, to me, is God ordained. It's a miracle. It was no figuring on my part, Virginia's part, or doctor's part, or anyone else. But we were brought together this way. I think God has a plan for everyone. And in his plans for me, that was one of the events that took place that got the whole thing rolling as far as I was concerned. Well, eventually, I don't want to go into all the things about how Doc scared the life out of me the first time I saw him and I ran out of him, but I did go back. And he put me in Akron City Hospital. And I'll never forget that. I went back to Akron after having run out on Doc. And it was a miserable 0 day. And I got bus fare down to Akron, but I didn't have any car fare when I got there to get out to that hospital. So I walked. As I said to someone today, Akron is known as the city of seven hills, just like Rome. But they're all uphill. There are no downhills in Akron. And I walked out to that city hospital in that 0 weather, minus an overcoat. And I recall I was perspiring. And as I went into the lobby of that hospital, I fainted. I passed out on the floor. And I said, sorry, I don't remember anything. Till I came to up in a room, and for some strange reason, they were giving me a bath. Well, a lot of people in white around there, but here's the old rummy in a person. I went down there to quit drinking, to get treated for my drinking, and I was looking for a medical treatment. And when I opened my eyes in that hospital room, the first thing I saw sitting over on the windowsill was a bottle of rub. And I was scared to death of DTs. I never had them. A lot of people have had a lot of entertainment with DTs. But I never had them because I was an everyday drinker. I never let them get a chance to start with me, I guess. But I never had a DT history anyway. But some of my buddies had, and I saw some dire results of them. And they frightened me very much. But I knew the answer for DTs is pour the biggest shot of booze in them that you can, and that'll chase those little men away. So I said to myself, said I, when looking at that alcohol over there, if I start hearing music and there isn't any band, and there's all kinds of funny people doing acts or funny animals doing acts out here like a circus, there is my answer in that rub. And that gave me courage. There was my ace in the hole. It's funny how you remember these things. But I remember the nurse came in with a tray. And she had two things on that tray. She had a big shot of some rather colorless whitish liquid. And also a great big hooker of whiskey. She says, Mr. Snyder, we have some medicine for you. You take this medicine, drink it, and follow it up with that nice whiskey. I'm looking at that rub over there, and I got on my muscle. I said, I came down here to quit drinking, and I will thank you for taking that away from here. And I gave her a few fine remarks. That is the worst thing I ever did. Because I lay in that hospital for a week, and I sweated, I shivered, I shook, I couldn't eat. I was in abject misery coming off of a drunk I'd been on for several years without a tapering off drink. Any person ever wants to try that, be my guest. So people don't have to tell me about coming off a drunk. I only came off of one in my life, and that was enough. I don't, for the life of me, understand these periodic alcoholics. They are crazy. You know, they're the guys that ought to be barred from the universe. They're the people that give us a bad name. Now, me, I don't bother anybody. I'm steady and dependable. I'm always drunk. But those nitwits, what do? They get a good job, they get a nice wife, a nice family, money in the bank, a couple of cars, belong to a club, and everything seems to be going along fine. All of a sudden, boom, they get drunk and the whole thing goes out the window. Away goes the wife, away goes the family, the house, the cars, the bank account, the job, the whole bit. What does this bird do after that? Here's what kills me. He gets another job, and usually a better one than he had. This is what gets me with these birds. He gets a new wife, a new house, new furniture, new cars, new family, everything going fine, and then bingo, away it goes again. Now tell me, what kind of people are they anyway? I never did anything like that. They give us the bad name. Grace is a periodic. But she was dry when I met her, thank goodness. She didn't know anything, but she does now. Well, we have a great time around our house. You know, I swore I would never marry an alcoholic. I swore up and down. Don't ever say never. Because I figured that somebody in the house had to have some sense. And so, but I did marry her. I met her one night, and the very same night I told her that we're going to live together the rest of our life. She looked at me and she scratched her head. That guy's either been sober too long or he drank too long. But 2.5 years later, we got married. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very much satisfied with it. Now, so much for the marital stuff. After I left that, when I was in that hospital, my sponsor, if any of you people, I know some of you folks here, I know less than some of you people have met him. Some of you have. And you remember Doc as a big, tall, angular fellow. And he had fingers on him this long. And he was a rectal surgeon. And Doc did not mince words. And he used a lot of slang expressions. And he was very gruff. He was not the softest speaker that I've ever met. And he was very direct. And I remember Doc used to name everybody. I don't know. I don't think he knew these fellas' names down there. But he named me, he called me young fella all the time. The only time I ever heard him holler Clarence at me, he had that Vermont accent, Clarence, he called me. The only time he called me Clarence is when he's mad at me, and I knew I was in for trouble. When he called me young fella, I'm sailing along all right. He was a rough sponsor, and that's exactly what I needed. Well, he put me in this hospital in Akron, and he had the men in Akron, Oxford Movement, the alcoholics, come to visit me. There were 14 of them. And they told me the stories of their life with booze and what happened to them. These men were all older men than I was by 10, 15, and 20 years. I was only 35 years old then. That's why I'm the last one left. I just outlived them, that's all. And I'll be 80 years old my next birthday, so I'm been around a little while too. But these fellas were all 10, 15, 20 years older than I was. They told me their stories of what happened to them through booze, and they all told me the same thing. As they were leaving, they told me they have the answer to my drinking problem. And on that note, they left. They didn't tell me what the answer was. They went. And I'm lying there wondering what's going on here, because I'm looking for anything down there. I'm looking for an operation or something. I'm in a hospital, and you're supposed to be getting something like that. And this guy's a rectal surgeon. Certainly an odd approach. Well, anyway, the last day I was in the hospital, Doc used to come in every afternoon and sit on the foot of my bed and look at me. And he used to take one of those big fingers and punch me in the chest all the time. Oh, I hate a guy that punches me in the chest when he talks to me. And he used to do this. So he came in the last day and he looked at me. He says, "Well, young fella," he says, "what do you think of all this by now?" I said, "Doc, well, I think this is great. All these men coming in to see me. They tell me the stories of their life and what happened to them. But I'm puzzled about one thing." And he says, "And what's that?" I says, "Well, they all tell me they have the answer to my drinking problem. And on that note, they leave. What happens? What you going to do to me now? What comes?" He threw me a real curve. Doc says, "We don't know about you, young fella. You're pretty young. We don't know you've had enough yet. Had enough? I weighed 130 pounds when I landed in that hospital. I'd been between jobs for several years. I had no more home than a rabbit. I had no money. I had no clothes. I had no opportunity for anything. A deep depression was on. Am I ready? I don't know if I'm ready yet. So I guess I finally convinced him that I was ready. So he says, okay, young fellow, I'll give you the answer to this. So he points that big finger at me. He says, young fellow, do you believe in God? Wow. That's the last thing I expected to hear from a doctor. I'm down there for medical treatment. I'm not attending a mission. And this kind of teed me off and it's frightened me. God, there's something wrong here. So he's waiting for an answer. And I says, well, the best I could come up with out of this blubber was, well, what does that have to do with it? I thought that was a pretty smart one. He says, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you or do you not believe in God? Now I'm getting frightened. They're not going to fix me unless I go along with this bird. So I come up with another bright one. I said, well, I guess I do. He said, there's no guessing about it. You do or you don't. This is a way to give the spiritual situation to new people. Now I am scared. Now I know I have to go along with this bird. So he's waiting for that answer. Do you or do you not believe in God? So finally he says, yeah, I do. He says, now that's fine. We can get someplace. He says, get down out of that bed and get on your knees. I'm still thinking about that surgeon business and the long fingers. I says, what for? He says, you're going to pray. I says, who's going to pray? He says, you're going to pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do, but you get down there and I will pray and you can repeat it after me and that'll do for this time. So he hauls me out of that nice warm nest onto that cold concrete floor in that shorty nightgown. And he put his hand on my head, and he uttered a prayer. I can't tell you exactly what it was, but I have a pretty good idea. But I do remember this. When he concluded, he shook hands with me. He says, young fellow, you're going to be all right. And that night, he carried me to a meeting at the home of T. Henry and Clarissa Williams, who headed up the Oxford movement in Akron, Ohio. The Oxford movement was not a movement for alcoholics. The Oxford movement was, they referred to the Oxford movement as a movement for sinners only. Most people in the Oxford movement were not alcoholics, they were civilians. They were earth people. And the alcoholics got in there by sufferance. But everyone who went to the Oxford movement went there because they were convicted that they had a lot of sins to overcome. And the Oxford movement had a plan of living that would help them overcome their sins if they would accept and apply their program. Their program was a 6-step program. And all of our program in AA is a 12-step program. We simply took the Oxford group 6 steps and made 12 out of it. We figured if alcoholics could screw up 6 steps, they could screw up 12 much easier. But that's where we got our 12-step program for any of you people that might be in doubt, because I hear some very weird things about how this program is put together. We just took it out of the Oxford movement, and of course the Oxford people took it from somebody else, because it all comes out of the New Testament. It comes out of the Sermon on the Mount and the Book of James. So if you want to find the solution to your program, there's the references, and you don't have to go all through the whole Bible to find it. You take the 5th, 6th, 7th chapter of Matthew and the book of James, you have our program. The book of James, of course, the Sermon on the Mount was the greatest sermon Jesus ever preached. He preached it to his disciples, not to the populace. teach them how they what they're going to be up against and how they should conduct themselves after he left or left them in prison. And the book of James is a healing ministry, and the theme of that is faith without works is dead. So if we are sick people, we need healing. The book of James tells us how to be healed. So there is where our program comes from. And I hear a lot of silly ideas about how this program got together, but there is a straight work. You take it from the horse's mouth. That's the way it was. So we didn't have, when I came to this fellowship, we didn't have what we have today, naturally. Doc took me to that Oxford group meeting, and this was a wild adventure. It was in T. Henry and Clarissa's home, and I walked into that home with him that night, and I got several distinct shocks. First of all, it was full of ladies, and I had not been in contact with ladies for a long time. And these people all seemed acting like they were having a family reunion. Everybody was interested in one another. They were hugging and all this kind of business, and talking and blabbering, and they were all pretty well dressed. And I walked into that home, and I'm talking about dressing. You know how I was dressed? I didn't have the overcoat, and this was February. I had mission clothes. I had one brown shoe on and one black one. I think someone else had a pair like that somewhere. But that's what I had. And unbeknownst to me, I got another shock. Doc had called Dorothy and sold her on the idea of giving me another shot at home. And my God, I walked into that place and there's Dorothy sitting there. But I never expected to ever see her again. And she's at that meeting. He'd gotten her down there and talked her into taking me back to Cleveland with her. He's going to get rid of me. Anyway, I looked that house over. When I walked in there, I hadn't been in a home like this for many a long day. Beautiful home. T. Henry Williams was a multimillionaire. He had a patent on something they put in rubber tires, and he got a rake off on every tire sold out of Akron. So he wasn't hurting for money. I walked in there. He had oriental rugs on the floor, beautiful paintings on the wall, a grand piano over in a corner, and a lot of little bric-a-brac and figurines sticking around, which I made a special note of. You take inventory of things when you go in a house like that. A piano is too much. I never took any of it, but I had it all inventoried. Well, anyway, these ladies, I couldn't figure out what all these women are doing there. They were not alcoholics. And a lot of men are on there that were not alcoholics. You could tell them from the rummies. They talk funny. They don't conduct themselves like alcoholics. So it's easy to distinguish earth people from rummies. And this is a great shock to me, but I will never forget those ladies, particularly three of them. Annie Smith, Doc's wife, Henrietta Seiberling, and Henrietta Dotson. They were awfully wonderful to me. And they did their best to make me feel at home, and they showed a love for me that I had never felt for a long time, if ever. So I owe those people a lot. They were not alcoholics. Well, when I left Akron that night, Dorothy took me home with her. And I stayed home in Cleveland with her for a little over a year, and she threw me out sober. I must have been a real prize. But all I'll tell you why it happened. I look back, and I can figure this out. Dorothy was a very fine person. She was a fine woman. Very bright, very intelligent, very good at business. She better be, because I couldn't contribute anything there. And she took a big interest in this AA stuff, and she used to entertain these guys that I'd bring home and play cards with them, stuff like that. But you know, Dorothy was always a social butterfly in our home. anybody coming to our house, they sure were not looking for me. They were looking for her. And after I come home and start AAing all over the place, strange people were coming to our door, not just alcoholics, but other people who their curiosity was aroused. They're beating on the door, and they're not asking for Dorothy, they're asking for me. And she'd been the major domo of that domicile for so long, she just couldn't adjust to this. And she got her nose out of joint, and in the event, she just disposed of me. So she had her position again. She felt threatened, I guess. That's the only way I can figure it out. Anyway, that broke up. Dorothy left. She married some other clown, a rummy. And this guy, if she thought I was something, she got in worse than she had before. But this guy belonged to a wealthy family, and she showed me one day, she went out of her way to let me know she was going to get married, she didn't need me, and she showed me a diamond ring, her engagement ring. That diamond is about as big as a potato. And I told her, well, sister, if you're going to marry that clown, you're going to earn that diamond. And she sure did. So God's working again. He was a pill head, and he was, oh, he was something else, this guy. His family owned a very high-priced jewelry shop up in Toledo, Ohio, but he wasn't allowed in a jewelry store. He was a remittance man. They paid him to stay out of the store. But they gave him a fancy income, and that's where he got the ring. Well, he used to get the eat these pills, and he got very abusive, and finally they put him in Veterans Hospital in Cleveland. He was supposed to die, and she left him there and went to California and left him there to die, but the bugger didn't die. They don't die that easily. He followed her out there, and she had a lot more abuse out there till he finally did die. He died full of pills and booze. Then she married several other guys. But she, let me tell you something. About 15 years after she'd thrown me out, she went into AA herself as an alcoholic. She got messing around with those rummies so much it made her crazy. So she became alcoholic also. And she was a big worker in AA out in the San Diego area. She helped in the building of that one big club out there. In fact, she was there the night she died. She passed on to her reward. Well, anyway, she married this Dr. Murphy out there, and they had quite a time. He was quite a guy, a retired dentist. That was the only good one she married. Well, I went on my merry way. When she threw me out, I was moved into a cheap boarding house down on Euclid Avenue in Cleveland, on 87th and Euclid, if any folks know where that is, if you've ever been there. It was a declining neighborhood, which had declined quite a bit. And it was a big house, and there were about 35 people living in this boarding house, all types. And there were about 7 or 8 of us rummies got in there. And the rest of them were all kinds of civilians. Different kinds, school teachers and what have you, all kinds of people. I paid $10 a week room and board at that boarding house, and I got 2 meals a day and 1 on Sunday. And I was on a drawing account of $20 a week. I went to work working for a Ford agency, and this man put me on a $20 drawing account. And that's all I ever seemed to get, as far as I can remember, because he must have had something going there himself, because I became his best salesman. I was still getting 20 bucks a week. Now, you figure out what I was doing with 20 bucks. I paid $10 for my room and board and got 2 meals a day and 1 on Sunday, which means I had to buy some extra meals. I also had haircuts to get and different things that Stella has to have. Out of the other $10, which is really going downhill in a hurry, and the rest of it, whatever I had left, I squandered on women. Believe me, I was the last of the great spenders. You know, it never seemed to concern me not to have a pocket full of money at the time. I didn't seem to need it for some reason or other. I got along without it. And I had, listen to this, I don't have a dime in my pocket most of the time. And I don't get one car. I own two demonstrators, not one. Most of the people I knew then didn't even have cars, but the ones they did didn't even have running boards left on them. They were wreckers, junkers they were driving around. I'm driving two brand new automobiles. I have a new Ford, a new Mercury demonstrators I'm using, and they're both in my name. Whenever I sell one, you keep one about 3 months and you sell it, and I'd make $100 or so on it when I sell it, but that did give me some extra money. But here's a rummy for you. Broke, flat broke, I'm driving two brand new cars. I'm hauling drunks around in them. God took care of me with those drunks. How would I handle them? I couldn't have got around the way I did. Well, anyway, things progressed. Doc told me when I left Akron that night to go back to Cleveland and spend the rest of my life fixing rummies as an avocation. And he underlined avocation. He said, this is a labor of love, and nobody should ever make any money off the misery of other people, other alcoholics. So I took my sponsors at his word. I went back to Cleveland, and I start chasing drunks. And believe me, there was no shortage of them. This was a depression time, and there were thousands and thousands of men just wandering around, didn't even have homes. So remember this, there was no book, there was no group, there was not even an Oxford group in Cleveland. I had to go 40 mile or 80 mile round trip to go to an Oxford group meeting in Akron when I go to a meeting. I went there every week, and I'd go down there weekends just to be around those people. There was nothing. I was alone, and there's 1.25 million people in Cuyahoga County there. So I'd walk up to some dingbat on the street, drunk, say, hey, you ought to quit drinking, you ought to be like me. That's a great approach. Well, I might say I met with quite a bit of resistance. And I might say some of it was physical. But you know this, that I continue to go to my meetings in Akron, be around those people. We had no book, we had no literature, we had nothing. And I kept pounding at people and going to these meetings, and I talked to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of assorted drunks, dipsomaniacs, what have you, till I finally sold my first baby. I was just driven with the idea that I'd never really belonged to anything till I'd sponsored someone. And I have put all my time, my effort, my energy, my ignorance, everything in it, try to sponsor somebody. And I finally sold my first guy. Well, I'll tell you about that guy. His name was Bill Hess. Some of you folks that have gray hair or no hair, you remember the Depression days in the 30s, a lot of people were without homes. They lost them. They couldn't pay for them. They went doubled up with people. If they could, double up with other people. And there were a lot of empty houses around, and a lot of men wandering around, and they'd get in any place out of the weather, so some of them would take squatters' rights in some of these vacant houses. And in the wintertime, they'd tear all the woodwork off and all this stuff and the wood stairs and what have you and burn it to keep warm in those houses. When the house was devoid of woodwork anymore, they'd move in another one. And this is the way a lot of them existed. And there would be 20 and more men laying around one of these houses, these vacant houses. I wandered into one of these houses that day. I don't know how I ever got over there. I know the good Lord put me there. Because I It was way on the other end of town. I had no business there. I was there, anyway. I go in there, and here's all these jugheads. They're all pretty drunk. Some of them are down, some of them are up. And I'm propositioning all of them to quit drinking, and I'm getting no place. But I get in the other room, and here's a guy lying on the floor, there on his back. And he is, I have never seen a character like this before. This man was dead drunk. He was paralyzed drunk. He could not move a muscle. But he knew what I was talking about, and he could respond. He could say yes and no. He could tell me. He could talk to me. He couldn't move. I don't know how long he was lying there, but there he was, lying on the floor. So I got down this guy, got right down with him, you know. And I asked him how he'd like to quit drinking, and he was all for it. The first guy that I ever got to go on with me, I got no resistance from him. Boy, that's all I needed. I've got a baby. So I went out and called Doc and told him I have a baby. I'm going to bring him down to the hospital in Akron. And I got some of those jugheads to help me pick this guy up and put him in the back of my car. And away we went down to Akron and put him in the hospital. That was my first baby. That was after 7 months and talking to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rummies trying to sell him this idea. You know, this is a sales job. I do not agree with that statement that says that they say in AA that this is attraction rather than promotion. That's the biggest bunch of hogwash I ever heard. This is a sales job, and you better believe it. And we are not doing our job too well nowadays. We're letting other people do it for us. This is a little warning I give you. We're letting these dry out houses do our job that we ought to be doing. Eh? This is one of the reasons we had this phenomenal success in those early days in Cleveland. We all worked, and we all went after it, boy, and we all sold. You're selling the greatest thing you can sell to a person when you get a rummy. If you get him qualified, you're selling him his sanity. You're selling him sobriety. You're selling him a chance to live. You're selling him a chance to make a good life for himself here. Yes, and I think you're preparing him for a good life somewhere else after he leaves here. It's quite a sales job. That's something to think about when you pick up a rummy. You have to be pretty conscientious to keep believing that. But that's the way it is. The way I always felt, that's the way a lot of these fellas felt that was around me at the beginning. Well, let me tell you about Bill Hess, that drunk. I talked to Bill. And, of course, when I was down there talking to him, I asked him the next silly question, could he get $50? I put him in a hospital. We might as well ask him for $50,000. It'd come just as close. He didn't have 5 cents. But he says this, my mother lives out in near Ashtabula, which is 60 miles from Cleveland, about 55 miles east of Cleveland. She's on a farm out there, and she has money. And if you tell her you found me, and you're going to fix me, she can give you the $50. That's all I needed. I got in my car, and away I go, 55 miles out in the country. I found this farm that she was living on, and it was on a lane that went way back. The house was sitting way back. Well, I was afraid to go back because it was kind of muddy back there. I didn't want to get stuck, so I parked the car on the road and started walking up this long lane. And then a frightful thought hit me. This was the first day of hunting season, and I hear guns going off everywhere. It sounded like the Battle of the Marne. And it came to me that these are probably buddies or relatives of Bill's, and they're probably all drunk, and they're running around with guns in their hands, shooting at everything that moves. And I'm moving down the lane. So I really stopped there and debated as to whether I ought to turn around, forget the whole thing or not. But I went on up to the house. I pounded on the door, and a little old lady came to the door. Little wizened old lady. And she looks at me. Bill forgot to tell me one important detail. Bill was Polish, and his mother was very Polish, and she did not speak English. And I know two words in Polish. I know Yaksimash and Dubse. And you can only Yaksimash and Dubse so long, and you run out of conversation. But there was a little kid there, probably 7 or 8 years old, probably a grandkid. And through him as an interpreter, I told this old lady about finding her boy, whom she hadn't seen in several years. And she got excited when he told her that, and he told her about the $50. Now, you know, the banks were closed in those days. If some of you will remember that, Roosevelt closed all the banks. He only let the Democrats' banks open. He never let the Republicans open theirs. But anyway, they were closed. But the people had money. They had it in tin cans, little lumps out in the backyard. You could see where they buried it. Or they had them in coffee jars, and they had them in mattresses. So this old lady went back in the bedroom and cut a lump out of the mattress and brought me some of those great big bills. Remember those big bills, the way they used to be? And I had my 50 smackers. That's all I needed. And away I went. Guns or no guns, I run down that thing and got in my car, went down, put Bill in a car, and took him to Akron. That was my first triumph. Something happened. It says something of, you know, it took me 7 months to get that first man. And I know now why it took me 7 months. It says something in our first chapter about carrying a message. I had a lot of energy, a lot of time, a lot of get up and go, a lot of ignorance, but I didn't have any message. I finally got a message. The evidence of that is right after Bill Hess was in that hospital, bing, 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 I had a dozen guys going down to that hospital. Right back, two over at a time, some of them. And we had a dozen men in our group already, in going down to Akron from Cleveland. Now, let me tell you how AA started. You hear a lot of fairy tales about the way AA started, but here is the dope. The Oxford Movement was a Protestant religious fellowship, and their literature was the King James Bible, and they read literature from the Methodist Church and others. And no Catholics were in the Oxford Movement because a Catholic was not permitted to belong to the Oxford Movement by his church. The Oxford Movement didn't keep them out. The Catholic Church kept them out. The church in those days was pretty narrow about a lot of things. They've changed a lot of these things over the years, but they're pretty rough then. Out of those first dozen men going to Akron, 7 of them were Catholics. We had an Irish invasion right after Bill Hess. As I said the other night, this is an Irish disease that's cured in Methodist church basements. But the Irish disease showed up, and they were going down there, and listen, they see this going on down there, this falderall in the Oxford Movement. And they told me they couldn't go. So, okay, I go down and see my sponsor about it and told him what our proposition was. They had no Catholics there. There was no Catholics in New York either. So Doc says, well, we're not keeping them out. He says, no, we're not keeping them out, but their church keeps them out. It's all the same thing. They can't come. He says, well, that's their tough luck. I said, no, Doc, it don't have to be. We had written this AA book in the fall of 1938, and this was May of 39 that I'm talking to Doc. The book came out in February 39, so the book had been out about 3 months, but I'm talking to Doc about this. The Doc, we have this program, we have a 12-step program, and that, along with the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love, anybody can live by that. It doesn't make any difference what kind of a religion he's attached to, if any. He says, well, you can't do that. I said, what can I do? He said, you can't do that. You can't break this thing up. I said, Doc, I'm not trying to break anything up. I'm just trying to open it up so everybody can get in it. He said, you can't do that. I said, well, we're going to do something. He says, like what? I said, you'll see. I had another Irishman in the hospital, Al Goldrick. You'll see his story in one of the later editions of the book. He thought he could drink like a gentleman, I think is the title of it. You'll recognize it when you read it. He was in there. I didn't talk to him. He's all smoked up with formaldehyde. But I went out to see his wife about using their house. He had a big house. Al was a patent lawyer. He was getting kicked out of his firm at the time. He's losing his house at the time. But fortunately, he salvaged it all. He saved it all after coming into the group. I went out to talk to his wife about using their house for a meeting place. We didn't know anything about renting halls. We didn't have any money anyway. So she was delighted with the idea. So I went down to Akron and made this announcement. Here's what started the first unity. I went down, I told them, people in Akron at the meeting, this is the last time the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We are starting our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, and I made the mistake of giving them the address. I shouldn't have done this. 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights, next Thursday night. And I said, this is not going to be known as an Oxford group next Thursday night. And I said, this is not going to be known as an Oxford group. We are taking the name from this book that just came out, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to be called Alcoholics Anonymous. And only, here's what blew the top, the roof off the house. And only alcoholics and their family are welcome, nobody else. Well, we were a minority down there, and those people were awful good to us. And I'm shutting them out, shutting all those people out from our activity. Boy, you should have heard the uprising. Clarence, you can't do this. It's done. You got to come down and talk about it. There's nothing to talk about it. Oh, it was awful. It was a riot. But I thought that was a riot I wish you'd have seen next Thursday night up on Stillman Road in Cleveland Heights. That whole group came up there and descended upon us and tried to break up our meeting. One guy was going to whip me. Bill Jones was going to give me a lathering. And I must say, this is all done in pure Christian love. But we stood our ground, and that's the way AA started. AA started in a riot, and it grows in riots. Nobody starts a group because we need a group. Somebody gets mad at somebody. That's what I call unity. Whoever started that unity, guys, that guy should have his head examined, whoever did that. If we ever had unity in AA, you know what we'd have? We'd have one great big group, three people doing the work, and everybody else getting drunk. We have to have leaders. We have to have people to get out there and beat those bushes and do the job. And everybody can't sit in the back row. Alcoholics are not made that way. We are a breed different than people. We are. We are not like people. We are different. Alcoholics are a breed of cats entirely different, and everybody can't be an alcoholic. Remember that. To be an alcoholic is a privilege reserved for a chosen few. I don't care how much people drink, some people can never become alcoholics. I drank with a lot of these birds, could drink an awful lot of booze, but they could quit drinking any time they got a different hobby. I couldn't do that. I don't think there's over 8 or 9, or probably at the most 10% of the population who can be alcoholic. Most of these heavy drinkers I see don't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. You have to have something on the ball to be a rummy. How can you and I think of the stuff we pulled off while we were drinking? I see alcoholics can operate on probably 20% of their efficiency and beat the socks off of Earth people that are operating on 80% of theirs. Yeah. I can give you a lot of examples of that, even in my own experience. No, alcoholics are a type. And here are some of the characteristics to look for in a rummy. I've never met an alcoholic worthy of the name yet that was not a high-strung individual. I never met one that wasn't quick on the trigger. He's not a deep thinker. He don't think. He emotes. He'll do something. He'll act. But don't get him to thinking. He gets in trouble. One of the biggest insults to an alcoholic is to walk into an AA group and see a think sign hanging up there. That is absolutely an insult to us. They should take them down. You know how those think signs got into AA? A boy down in Also Haswell, he was a great old guy, but he got thinking once, which is fatal for an alcoholic. He got a hold of a whole bale of these think signs that the IBM used to give out to their the different people in offices around the country, and they used to hang them over the water fountain there to inspire the help in the office. And he thought it'd be a great idea to send those around, and he got the directory, I guess, and sent those to every blooming group in the country and out of the country, and they dutifully hung them up. Thing. If he'd have put up there not think, but scheme, then we got something. Alcoholics are very sensitive souls. They're always going around looking for someone to hurt their feelings. They're the biggest liars that ever wore shoes. They lie when they don't have to. They lie for practice. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they're very social people. They want to have someone, but they're afraid. They hold you at arm's length. They never let anybody get too close to them. They don't. They are born and reared in fear. And this is one of our biggest enemies, is fear. And every one of us that I've ever met, when you look back on his life, I know in my own instance, I was raised on fear. I raised on it in Sunday school when I was a little kid. I raised on it at home. If you do this, you're going to hell. If you don't do this, you're going to hell. I'm always going to hell. Never heard of me going anyplace else. Fear, fear, fear. What do you think that does to a person in your formative years? That stays with you. One of the biggest problems we have is overcome fear. That's first. I've never met an alcoholic that did not have what they call an inferiority complex, a feeling of inadequacy. One of the first things I have to do when I ever work with an alcoholic is to build him up. I try to make him get a decent feeling about himself because he don't believe it. Everybody's been telling him what a slob he is for so long. He's got a very poor self-image when he gets here. Some people work just the opposite of that, and that's why they cripple so many alcoholics on AA. First thing, make that guy think he's something. I tell him why he's somebody. I tell him this, and it's the truth. I don't care what line of work an alcoholic, a real alcoholic, I'm not talking about the stupid drunk, I'm talking about the alcoholic. I don't care what he's in, if he's a teacher, if he's a lawyer, a doctor, if he's a salesman, if he's a mechanic, whatever he is, you'll always find him in the top 10. He is superior. When I came into this fellowship, I couldn't go back in the banking business. I was probably blackballed, and I don't think I could have handled it anyway. I had to change everything. I went into sales work. And I've been in sales work for many years till I decided it's easier to loaf than work, so I don't work anymore. But I've sold a lot of things, a lot of things. Most of the things I've sold have been, I've sold big ticket items and little ticket items. But I've sold intangible, I sell ideas. And I know in selling, I've also been a sales manager for a number of outfits. I've trained salesmen, so I know what they need, and I know what has to be cultivated in them. But you and I are salesmen, and we have to learn to judge and to analyze people.
Marcus, you can't judge people. What do you mean you can't judge people? You get a sixth sense about people when you deal with them long enough. I've been dealing with alcoholics for over 44 years. They can't tell me anything new. I've heard every story they ever told. You tell me a new story about rummy, I'll be glad to listen to it, but you can't do it. In 44 years, you've heard them all. I met a lot of rummies. I've listened to a lot of their ploys and seen a lot of their workings. And I know just what's coming next all the time with them, really. And you do this in sales work, same way. I learned, and the salesman only has his time. And I find out in selling, and remember, we're selling AA. Don't you ever forget that, the greatest sales job you're doing. When you're selling anything, you have to know your product first. You have to have enthusiasm for it, second. You have to know how to present it in a way that's acceptable, third. You got to know who you're talking to, fourth. You got to qualify your prospects, fifth. Same way, that's what I did in my business. I was a very successful salesman, always. I'm not bragging about it. The record stands for itself. I sold education, I sold correspondence courses for years, I sold franchises, I sold it. And I know what I have to do to sell, and I know what I have to do to sell AA. I learned to say AA selling the hard way. And I just try to pass along some of these things that save you a lot of bumps. They profit by experience. You don't have to learn everything the hard way. I had to learn a lot of things the hard way. You don't have to. You know, I'm just outlining some of these things about the early days of AA to give you an idea what you have here. When we started our group in Cleveland, the first AA group in the world, I remember very distinctly one night looking at that crowd up at Goldrick's house. And I said to myself, boy, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had as many as 35 members there. Eh? You know, it wasn't 2 years' time, we had 35 groups in Cleveland. Right? When I said that night, it would be impossible for anyone to ever even conceive that AA would be what it is today. It's everywhere. Every town you go into, every country you go into, you name it, AA is there. Right? At one time, there's nothing. A dozen guys. Eh? Why did it go like this? We have something. You know about alcoholics? Let me tell you something about alcoholics and alcoholism. Alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. You read about alcoholism in ancient history. You read about it in mythology, and you read about it in the Bible. There's a lot of good rummy stories in the Bible. Tomorrow, I think I'll tell you some of them, because it's Sunday. We'll have a Sunday school lesson. What I'm trying to say is alcoholism's been with us for a long, long time. I think I said the other night, I have a book about Ray Fitz on the history of alcoholism that was written back in the early 1800s, and it goes back centuries, laying out what people try to do to modify alcoholics drinking, and everything failed. Never anything succeeded. As you heard last night when Marinello was talking, there was only two ways. I know, I mentioned that the other night too. The only two places people run is to go before AA. One was the Samaritan cure and one was the Keeley cure. Both of them were aversion treatments. They just stuff you full of beer and wine and whiskey and put Epi-Tac in it and make you sick as a dog. With the idea that if you get so sick, you never want to look at it again. Well, it never worked. These guys get drunk on the way home from there. But we have the answer here. We have the answer in AA. You know what I think happened? All these centuries, alcoholics, millions of them, have stumbled across the face of this earth. And they existed and died in alcoholism, in misery, in disgrace, and in many instances carried their own families and some of their friends down with them. This has been going on for centuries. There's no out. The alcoholic only had two options all this time, all these centuries. He could go crazy, or die, or both. Finally, Alcoholics Anonymous came into being, and this is a big moment in history. Believe me, it's probably the most important thing that happened in this century or any century, in my estimation. The alcoholic got a third option. He can still go crazy, he can still die, but he can get well. He can now get well. Never could happen before. This is why so many strange people came bounding on my door up there in Cleveland in those early days. They couldn't understand what was going on. What do you do to these people? How is this happening? It had never happened before. I was mentioning the other night, somewhere, I was born in 1902. And if you look back in this century, a lot of marvelous things have happened. I saw the beginning of the automobile industry. I saw the beginning of the airplane industry. I saw the beginning of radio. I saw the beginning of television. I've seen men land on the moon. I've seen the terrific things happen in the development in science and medicine in this century. But I'm standing here to tell you I don't think any of them are near as important as what happened in 1938, May, when this program got going. You and I are God's chosen people. The Jews like to say they are the chosen people, and they are. They're chosen twice if they happen to be a rummy. But you and I are chosen to do something that no one else can do. You and I have a ministry working with alcoholics. And there isn't one person sitting in this room that is not an authority. Because you've been through that mill, you have something to share, and you have something to sell. And you can do it, and all the smart people in the world have tried, and they can't. But you and I, as rummies, can do this. Let me tell you something about some of these things that happened. You know, after we got going for a while in Cleveland in the fall, we got going in May there in the fall, I found a newspaper man out in a bug house. He'd been probated by his wife. And a little guy, a non-alcoholic man, a little Jewish insurance man, called me. This Jerry Halley called me about this fellow and says, this guy is worth salvaging. And his wife's got him put away in a bug house out here. He ought to go out and see if he can't fix him, do something with him. So Jerry and I went out to see Elrick Davis. And I talked to Elrick about this thing. And boy, all he wants to do is get out of that joint. So he's willing to do anything. So I gave him the book, copy of the book, told him to read it. And I said, if you get out of here, maybe you can write something and get yourself started back in the newspaper field. It's all right with him. But then I had to go out and sell his wife on the idea of letting him out. That wasn't as easy as talking to him, believe me. But she did. She got him released. And he wrote these articles in the Cleveland Plain Dealer in the fall of 39, rather. And that's the thing that put AA on the way to where it's going. We had publicity there for a week. Another writer wrote for 3 days. Then a minister there who tried to fix me years before preached a sermon. I went back to see this minister a year after I sobered. He didn't know me. I gave that guy an awful lot of aggravation. I didn't think he'd ever forget me. But I looked different a year later. When finally dawned on him who I was, he couldn't believe it. And then I told him about this, and he wanted to meet some of these men. Then he went to work and preached a sermon, and he used my life story as his sermon topic. He preached his sermon, Mr. X and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the Mr. X. And he had the Plain Dealer the next morning published his sermon on Monday morning in the paper. They used to publish somebody's sermon every Monday morning. They picked his that time, fortunately for us.
And then he had that sermon put in pamphlet form. That's the first pamphlet AA ever had. And he had them printed, and he gave them to us, how many we needed. Well, that's the way we did. All of those inquiries from the plane dealer came through my hands. And all of them that came to him came through my hands. And all that came to other contacts I was making. And here's the way we started. Here's the way we did things. I'd give every man a handful of these on Monday morning and tell him to go out and come back to tell me Wednesday what he did with them all. Just like a sales manager. And they did it. They were crazy to go out and work. Those guys are running wild around Cleveland and around those places. At night, I sat at home writing correspondence courses in AA to people out of state and out of the city, people that wrote in. I answered those. I also chased some of them down myself. Well, people came in so fast, we were having an awful time trying to absorb them, because we didn't have that all that many men. So I was trying to find out some way that we could train these people in classes. I didn't have any money to rent a hall, and I was trying, and I was asking the good Lord to give me some direction on this, as we always ask him for a direction in everything. So one day I went out chasing some of these down, and I had one of them in my hand there, the name of Walter Beilstein. Well, it means nothing to me, but the address was in a neighborhood that had been declining somewhat. They had these big homes down there, these millionaires' homes, these 24-room houses and that, with the carriage house in the rear. And I got out there, and this is what they call Little Hollywood in Cleveland. It was declining, and there's a lot of hustlers and what have you out there. And this was a funeral parlor, Beilstein Funeral Home. And I went up on the porch, and I went in, and I asked for Walter Beilstein. And the guy says, "Who?" I says, "Walter Beilstein." He says, oh, Walter. And I know I'm in the right place. He says, "He's not in here. He lives up over the carriage house in the rear. You'll find him up there." So I go back and go upstairs and rap on the door, and here comes this guy to the door, Walter. He's wearing a beret. And in those days, guys with berets were looked upon with some suspicion. Well, anyway, Walter comes to the door. He's very affable, he's very polite, and he's very drunk. And he invited me in. So I go in that place, and boy, one look at that place, and it's a theater. He's got a hold of about 200 picture show seats from some show that went out of business, and he has them stapled to the floor. And one end of his place is a stage with all the drops and props and stuff. And he lives in the other end. He has his bath and his kitchen and all that stuff in bed in the other end. And I look at that place. I've been praying for a place to train people in classes. I said, "Walter." "Yeah." "I said, you are a gift from heaven." He says, "I am." "You sure are." I said, "Do you know what we're going to do, Walter?" See, Walter was putting on amateur theatricals up there. That was his hobby. He had one other hobby. He had a Great Dane dog. And I wish you'd seen this dog. 165 pounds. It's like a horse running around the house up there. That was his chum, that horse, that dog. That was real some dog. Playful thing. He'd get up on you, knock you on your can. He liked to do that. Well, 165 pounds can do it. Well, Walter, I says, "You know what we're going to do?" He says, "What?" I says, "We're going to fill those seats every night." That's all he wants to hear. He wants those seats filled up. I says, "How many seats you got?" He says, "I don't know, about 200. We'll fill them up every night." Well, that's all he likes, get those seats filled up. Because he thought we were going to run some shows or something. Well, you know, I made Walter a captain. "Walter, you are a captain in AA, first and only captain we ever had." So Walter, everybody used to call him Captain Walter. And he loved that title. And old Walter got busy, and he forgot all about drinking, And he was a real captain around there, and he was having the time of his life, because nobody paid any attention to Walter. He was an outcast with his family and everybody else. But Walter never knew anything about girls. Walter was in his early 30s, a nice fella. And he got running around at these hospitals where we had drunks, and he saw girls. And he meets a girl, a nurse, and he looks at that nurse, and Walter, funny things start happening. Walter, in here, he got an itch that he couldn't scratch. And he starts to get acquainted with this gal, this nurse. The next thing you know, he's courting her. And the next thing you know, Walter asks her to marry him. This is the only gal Walter ever knew. So this girl agreed to marry Walter on one condition. That dog was too much in the house. The dog would have to go. Well, that dog was his boon companion. He loved that dog, and the dog loved him. And this was a terrible decision for Walter to make. And he stewed about that for a week or so. But you know, love will conquer all. So Walter, finally, he broke down, and he gave the dog to some people way out in the country, and they got married. Well, things were steaming along pretty well for a while, and I noticed Walter is starting to get slowing up. He isn't his same old self. Something's wrong with Walter. So I said, Walter, come over here, boy. I said, something wrong with you. Tell Papa what's wrong here. Tell me what's wrong. What's eating of you? I miss my dog. I said, well, I'm sure you do, Walter, but you made a deal with Mary. I still want my dog. I said, well, Walter, I know you made a deal, and Mary isn't about to have that dog move in, but I said, you might talk to her. Maybe she'll give you weekend visiting privileges. I didn't think she would, but hope springs eternal. So he talked to Mary about having the privileges, but she refused that, too. So Walter liked that dog, loved that dog, so he threw her out and got the dog back. I'll tell you, we had characters you wouldn't believe. We had those men coming up there every night of the week to Walter Bauerstein's house, back at the funeral home. They come up those stairs, and here's something that happened. The neighbors are wondering what's going on upstairs in that, over that, behind that funeral home. All these men, 100 or so men streaming up there every night. They know there's something nefarious going on up there. So they want to know what's going on in their neighborhood, so they send the police over. So one evening, the cops come in, and the sergeant comes in. I greet him at the door and ask him his pleasure. He says, I want to talk to you about what are you guys doing up here? And he's looking around. He recognizes a lot of those birds in there, because they've been customers of his in a wagon for year after year. I said, and I told him, we fixed these guys. We sober them up. He said, you mean to say that one's sober and that one's sober and that? So go smell them. They don't drink? No, they don't drink. They ain't going to drink. They'll never drink again. I said, what face we had. Oh, he looked his bunch over and they left. There's nothing he could do. A couple nights later, a little old lady come charging up there. And she wants to know what's going on in her neighborhood. It's full of these men, and she recognizes some of these birds because she's been sweeping them off her lawn in the morning and stuff like this. And she wants to know, and I told her the same thing I told the cop. She said, you mean those guys are not drinking? That one and that one? That? No. You mean they're not going to drink? Never. They'll never drink. Then she softened up. She says, I have a boy. He's on the bum somewhere. Can you fix him, too? Sure, we can fix anybody. I said, where is he? He's in New York. Oh. Says, whereabouts in New York? I don't know. He's on Skid Row. Skid Row, New York, that's something to find. Something rummy from Cleveland. I says, well, I tell you, we have some guys up in New York. So I gave her Bill Wilson's name, The address? I says, we got some guys up there. I'll get in touch with them. First, I says, I'll get in touch with them. She said, no, who do you got? Who do you have? So I give her Bill's name and address. That old lady's on the first Rattler going to New York the next morning. And she confronts Bill, of course. But here's what happened. The very day, she had a daughter living in New York City. Now, she hadn't heard from her son for about 2 years. He used to be a sales manager for one of the big distilleries. He was advertising manager for Calvert Distilling Company. I think he believed his ads too well. And he wound up on Skid Row. The very day she'd landed in New York at her daughter's place, this guy called his sister while his mother was there. What do you call that? She hadn't heard from him for a couple of years. What do you call that? So they got a hold of this bird. Do you know what happened to that guy? He became the first editor of our grapevine. He lived a sober life for many years. He just died about 2 years ago. Wonderful fellow. Here's the old lady in Cleveland. Her boy is out there on the Skid Row in New York. And it brings it all together. And he comes in here and he's a very active person in this AA activity the rest of his life. Wonderful fellow. He got married. Beautiful wife he had. Several years ago she died. I remember that so well. He just passed away a short time ago himself. These miracles that come along that happen, it's hard for people to believe this. Now talk about women. We like to talk about women. There were no ladies in AA in those days. Doc Smith and Bill Wilson were against female alcoholics. They were poison. In those days, there was a terrible double standard as far as women were concerned. Any woman that got drunk was a bum in everybody's estimation. I mean, that was it. She was a hooker in everybody's estimation. She was a lot less than what a lady should be. And they didn't want them. The first gal that I ever sponsored, she was in a hospital in Chicago. Get this, Chicago. She'd been in and out of that hospital numerous times with booze and pills. I had a sister-in-law as a nurse in that hospital. And Carolyn said to this gal one day, she says, hey, you ought to go to Cleveland and see my brother-in-law, my ex-brother-in-law. And he fixes drunks, and he can fix you. She got on a train and came to Cleveland and came and moved into my house for about 3 weeks. I was still with Dorothy then. And I looked everywhere to find these pills. I went to all the hems of her garments, to her bags, to every place that was legal. I looked for these pills. And I couldn't find them. But finally she got straightened up and she went back to Chicago. When she went back there, I gave her Earl Treat's name. Earl had been in the Oxford movement in Akron when I was down there, and his business took him to Chicago, and he didn't do anything about fixing drunks out there. He was sitting on his big fat behind. She went out there, and she lit a candle under that old boy, and they went out, along with Grace Cultus. They started the Chicago group. That's the one girl. I want to tell you about another gal. Tell you about several of them. First, I'll tell you about one that when I was living in this boarding house, this little gal was named Marie. She was a hooker, and her territory was out in front of my house, this boarding house. She had a 2 blocks that she walked up and down, and business was always poor in those days. After all, there was a depression on. And she had a nuisance value. She'd come into my boarding house, where I was living, and she'd come right back to my room, and she'd put the arm on me for a quarter. She had a 2-bit nuisance value to get rid of her. And I was in trouble with old lady Mack, the landlady. She didn't like that hooker coming in there. She said, we got enough broads around here now. We don't have to get anyone out of the streets. And I was about ready to get thrown out of there because of her coming in there. Of course, the old lady Mac didn't understand what was going on here. So finally, I had to figure out some way to get rid of this gal. She, meantime, had gone into, before this happened, had gone into AA. And she got enamored of some guy, and this romance blossomed for about 6 weeks. And then this guy dumped her for somebody else, and she went back on the street again. So she's parading up and down, coming in and bothering me all the time. Well, anyway, I got to find some way to get rid of her in a humane fashion. So I went to the state liquor store. I hadn't been in one of these stores for a long time. In fact, I wasn't allowed in them while I was drinking. They got a law in Ohio. You can't go in there drunk, and I was always drunk. I went in and said to this guy running the state liquor store, what do you have here? The worst whiskey you got in the place. Something that'll turn people inside out. He looked at me like I'm daffy. I said, yeah, I mean it. He said, you do? He said, well, I think I got something for you. So he went out in the back of the place and brought a quart bottle of Old Cotton Picker. Old Cotton Picker. It was a Kentucky corn whiskey. And it cost me 90 cents for the quart. So it wasn't the greatest, you know. And I take my Old Cotton Picker and take it home and put it in my drawer at home. Sure enough, Marie comes floating in another night or so and wants a drink. I says, Marie, you are in good fortune. I have a drink right here for you. You don't have to go out and scrounge for it. I got a drink right here. Oh, she was happy about that. I says, but I tell you what, Marie, I'm in trouble here with old lady Mac. And I want you to drink this drink right down and get out of here and don't come back. Do me a favor. I've been trying to be good to you, but take this down and blow. Don't bother me anymore. Okay. I poured her out a water glass full of Old Cotton Picker. I said, now take this and drink it down. Don't even take a breath. And she did. And boy, when that hit her, you think you hit her on the head with a mallet. She fell on her butt, and there she lay. It knocked her flatter than a rug. So I dragged her out of there, and that was the last time she ever came back for a drink. But I kept the cotton picker, and there's Paul Simon was a fellow that was a cast-off of a very wealthy family, and he was living in that place. And he had a pal that he used to go to college with, that this guy's family were multimillionaires. They had polo ponies and all that stuff out in Gates Mills out east of Cleveland. And this Robbie was a pretty boy. He had real wavy black hair. And he looked more like a girl than anything else. And Paul was trying to get him to come to get dried out in Post Shaker Sanitarium. So finally, and he hated my guts. This fellow Robbie hated me like the devil hates holy water. And every time we'd run into each other, he would tell me something about my ancestors and all this stuff. And I just irritated this guy. We just had a personality clash. Well, anyway, Paul said, finally come back there one noon. He says, Robbie's out here and he wants to go in, but he wants a drink first. You got anything to drink? Now, that guy wouldn't wash his feet in Seagram 7 Crown. He had the best of everything. He was a millionaire kid. I said, yeah, I just have the drink for Robbie. Just the thing. So I pour a water glass full of this Old Cotton Picker and go up to Robbie's room with it. And as soon as I go in, why, Robbie greets me with the usual four-letter words, and I respond in kind. And I start to irritate him. And I said to him, I said, you know, you want a drink. You look more like a girl than a boy. I don't think you know anything about drinking. I said, you drink like a girl. You look like a girl. I think you are a girl. You're not a man. And he get mad as a wet hen, see? So he says, I'll show you I can drink. I said, you can't drink. Yeah, I'll show you. All right, you show me. Let me see you drink this water glass full of booze without taking a breath. I'll show you, you SOB. And he shakes that, grug, 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 down he went. We picked him up and threw him in a car and took him in, and at the last drink Robbie ever had. It's the last drink he ever had. He sobered up. If he's living, he's still sober today. After a year or so, we got on good terms, but there you had to irritate this guy. You give them what treatment they need. You have to know your prospect when you're selling this. Okay. Well, now, let me tell you about a girl. Somebody said I only got a short time on the tape. I can't worry about tape. Are you worried about tape? You know, there was a girl, I made a lot of contacts with social workers and people like that. And Miss Mooney was a social worker. She sent me several men, whom we fixed. She called me up one day and says, "Do you fix women?" "Sure, we fix women." We didn't have any, but we fixed them just the same. She says, I got one for you. So I went down to meet this genius that she had. This girl's name was Catherine. Catherine was very thin. I used to call her old 6 o'clock. She's straight up and down. Had about as much shape as a lead pencil. And she was Irish, and she's rather young, and she had the most filthy mouth of any person I ever heard. She could swear. I never heard anything like it. I've often said I think she taught sailors how to swear. So there she was. She had belonged to a very wealthy family once, and they threw her out because she'd been playing patty cake with one of her uncles and broke up his home. And she was on her own, but she'd been educated abroad. She had a good education. And she was on the street, and Catherine would do anything for a drink. Anything. And she looked it. So Mooney introduced me to Catherine, and so fine, everything went fine. A couple of weeks were getting along great. Catherine isn't drinking, and things are going good. I used to go home at noon, go to the rooming house at noon, a lot of times to get away from the store. And one day I'm walking down the corner to the drugstore, and here comes Catherine up my direction, and she's so drunk she can't hit the sidewalk with her hat. She is really drunk. Catherine had been out to that Warrensville workhouse so many times that she was serving a life sentence on the installment plan. She'd go in for 30, 60 days, come back, and back out again. That was her home away from home. So here she's drunk. So I said, "Catherine, you just got out of the pokey. You're going to go right back in. Let's get home." So I wanted to take her home. Okay. So she was Irish, and she was really had a loud mouth and a dirty one. And she suddenly decided she wants something to eat. Now, this is noontime. This is happening. Well, I know that Catherine is not capable of doing much in the heat side, so I try to steer her into a Greek restaurant there, and she looks in there and looks at me. She says, "I wouldn't eat in a dump like that." It had those enamel tables, you know. She says, I want a tablecloth where I eat, that bum. Oh, so I try to humor her, and I want to get her off the street, and I made a terrible error. I took her down to 79th Street, and there's a nice spaghetti restaurant down there, an Italian restaurant. Carpets on the floor, tablecloths, and men waiters with the dickies and the whole thing, you know, tuxedos they're wearing. So we go in there, and as soon as we got in there, I knew that I had made the mistake of a century. Because she's loud, she is profane, and she stinks. And we go in there, and the head waiter meets us and takes us to a table, and she's having a few words with him on the way. And we get seated, and he leaves, and she flings a few remarks as he goes. The waiter came and took her order, and she ordered spaghetti. I know she has about much chance of having spaghetti as I have climbing over that building. But she ordered it. Well, meantime, she's having some problems with the people in the next table over here. And she's exchanging pleasantries with them about their ancestors. Now, remember, these are all professional and business people having lunch in there. It's a nice, refined place. They're not used to any such stuff. So that ain't bad enough. She's having trouble over here with another table and then a table behind her. The next thing you know, the whole damn restaurant's in an uproar. The head waiter comes back and tries to shush her, and she tells him a few things, and he blows. The waiter then brings her spaghetti and sets it down, and she dismisses him. And then she starts to wear this spaghetti. She sure can't eat it. It's coming down here. By this time, as I say, that restaurant's in an uproar. And the head waiter comes back and advises us we have to leave. Well, she don't like this guy because he represents authority. She'd had trouble with him before, and he had the nerve to come back and tell her to get out, and she don't like this, so she did nothing but pick up that plate of spaghetti and give it to him right in the kisser all over his, run down over his dickie. Well, in about 2 minutes, the wagon was there, and Catherine and I are both in the wagon. Down we go to the pokey. They put Catherine in some place back, and they left me out in the front there. They put me in a cage out front here. And I'm rattling this bloody cage, and I'm trying to tell these monkeys in there that I don't belong here, and they assured me nobody does. And I'm making a lot of noise, and finally I give up. It's no use. I'm stuck. So I just lay down and rest a while, and finally they changed shifts. A new bunch of cops came on. So I started my rattling all over again, and one guy came over to see what's going on here. And I told him, I says, you just call, what's his name,
Crowley.
Yeah, call Crowley, the probation officer. He'll tell you all about me. He said, you know Crowley? I said, sure. You know, call him and see. I don't belong in here. He'll tell you about it. So I guess he called Crowley, because they didn't even let me call anybody, if you can imagine that. So Crowley had a fit. He laughed. He thought it was the funniest thing. I get pinched with that broad. So he came down and got me out. But they kept Catherine. Well, they took Catherine away and she was gone. I didn't see any more of Catherine for some time, a month or so. I'm walking up to the drugstore again. This is a dangerous place for me to walk. And here comes Catherine again. And if anything, she's drunker than she was the other time. I said, Catherine, you just got out. You'll go right back in again. Let's get off the street. Let's go home. She said, okay. I said, we don't eat today, Catherine. Okay. Now, she was so bad that I was afraid to cross Euclid Avenue with her. So I took her up to 82nd Street where there was a light up there, a traffic light, where I could cross in some semblance of safety with her. And I'll never forget that corner. There's a Unitarian church on one side and a Jewish temple across the street. And I'm waiting for this light with Catherine, and all of a sudden she feels the call of nature. And don't you know, she squats right there. And I'm standing there holding her hand. And she's rocking around. This would make a good movie. You know, it's high noon and all the people, there's 1,000 people walking around the street there. And a lot of interested passers-by stop. And she has a word with them. And they have a word. And as it goes on, there's a crowd coming around pretty soon. You don't know what's coming next. That damn wagon showed up again. Down we go. And I'm in that place again. So I can't get any place with these birds. Same dummies in there. So I wait till 3:30 or whenever it was when the new crop came on. And this guy saw me. I thought he'd have a hemorrhage laughing. So Crowley, he called Crowley. Somebody had to get me out. They wouldn't let me out. So Crowley had fits. And I get caught twice with that crazy broad. So I got out, but they took Catherine again. So between Mooney and Crowley and the judge, I told him there's no way this girl's ever going to live unless she's put away for a long period of time. She can't possibly exist. She's going to die this way. I recommended to give her a sentence of, as a habitual, give her a year and a day. And the judge did. Gave her a year and a day. Well, I know Catherine knew I had a hand in this, so I did not go around to see her because, oh boy. But I knew someday I'd have to. So one day the matron called me and told me Catherine wants to see me. So I went down to the dime store and bought her some gumdrops and some sink water and some talcum powder and some cigarettes. I think I invested 60 cents in her, which was a big investment for me. And I had them in a bag and I headed out there 18 miles to Warrensville. And man, when I went in there, the air got blue. She, I'm telling you, that girl could swear. I never heard this going on. This was all directed at me this time. And she went on and on. There's nothing I could do but wait till she run down. All she wants is out of there. I said, Catherine, you're not leaving here. You're staying a year and a day. Of course, then the balloon goes up again, you know. Oh, it was something. So finally, after the second tantrum she had, they had a little thing. I could put this thing through and give it to her. And she accepted my little peace offering. And I went out to see that crazy woman every week, the whole year she was out there. And after I went a few times, she quit hollering about getting out. She knew she wasn't going to get out. But here's the end of the story, as Paul Harvey says. That gal, see, they put her in the hospital ward out there and got her cleaned up. That girl probably had everything from dandruff to fallen arches, the kind of life she was living, you know? And they didn't have those wonder drugs like they had today. But they cleaned her up. And she started getting some meat on her bones. And she stayed there for her whole year. And when she got ready to go, Mooney and I went out to pick her up. And we brought her in. And Mooney got her a room way out by Euclid Beach Park, away from all the places she'd been before. Living with some old bohemian people, knew nothing about alcoholics. And got her a job on one of the Cleveland's bathing beaches as a lifeguard. She could swim like a fish. She worked there all year until Labor Day when the beach closed. And Mooney got her a job at one of the hotels as a room clerk. And she went to night school and took a refresher course in her typing and shorthand, which she knew something about. And she got a job as a secretary. She saved her money. That girl was the tightest person I ever saw in my life. As I've often said, she wouldn't spend a dime to see the original crucifixion. But she was saving her money for a purpose. Finally, she went into the real estate business and she became a very wealthy woman. I tried to take her to a meeting one night and the women threw her out. They wouldn't have her. I took her to a meeting up at Goldrick's home. The women wouldn't have her in there. But I took her to some picnics and places where she didn't have any identity. But she went back into her church. She was Irish and she was Catholic. She hadn't been in a church in a long time. But an odd thing, she was very good with kids. And she worked with young people and with kids in that church. And that's what she dedicated her time to, working with these kids. She was very good at it. That woman became wealthy. The last I heard of her, she was living in Palm Beach, Florida. Still single, still waiting for me. That girl taught me something that no one could have taught me. They used to say in those days, if a woman goes a certain way down, there's no coming back. She refuted all that stuff. Nobody in my experience has ever gone near as low as that girl had been. And she made it. She never had a drink the rest of her life. Well, I could just stand here and tell you all kinds of things about these. I want to tell you one thing about what happened the first banquet we ever had in AA. We have a lot of them now. You have them every place. Back in 1941, somebody got an idea in Cleveland that we ought to have a dinner and invite all the first people around. So I went out and made arrangements with the Lakeshore Hotel, which would take care of a couple hundred people. And we're going to have there Doc, Bill, Henrietta Cyberling, who introduced the two of them, and Bill Dotson, the first man, and Wally Gillum, who used to take drunks into his house and shake them out. And I was the MC. First thing I know, that Lakeshore Hotel can't handle it. So we had to cancel those reservations and go down and get a reservations of Statler downtown. We had our first banquet at the Statler Hotel. We had 989 people at this banquet. There was a couple hundred came after the banquet just to hear the speakers. Bill was there, Doc was there, Henrietta Cyberling, and Bill Dotson, Wally Gillum, and as I say, I was the MC. That was some party. The banquet at the Statler Hotel was $1.25. That was in 1941. And I had bouquets, boutonnieres for the ushers, and I had the ushers mix everybody up. The Canton people couldn't stay with Canton people, Akron people couldn't stay, mixed them all up. And we had corsages for all the ladies up on the dais there. And when we finished that banquet at $1.25, we had $7 left over. How do you like them apples? And that was some banquet. Those are some of the things that happened in the early days. I could stand here all night and tell you about some of these experiences. I don't know if you're interested in them or not, but you ought to. But I'll save some of it for tomorrow. We have a lot of things to talk about tomorrow. I just want to get into the beginnings of AA tonight and let you all realize what wonderful thing you belong to and you are a part of and what your responsibility is. Because you and I have a responsibility. Because you and I, as I said before, are the only persons who can fix rummies. And let's confine our activities to rummies. Let's not try to fix the whole world. We have all we can pray over to take care of alcoholics. There are facilities for these other people. Let them go to those facilities and let you and I spend our time and our effort, our experience with the people we can work with best. I'm a great believer in planting where your seed has a chance to grow. And you and I can plant seeds among alcoholics and they will grow. It's been nice talking to you. I don't know how long I've talked. I'm glad he ran out of tape. This is nothing unusual. It's only been a couple hours, so that's easy. Anybody a little behind hurting? Well, we'll close it up for now, and God bless all of you, and we'll get together sometime tomorrow. Thank you.